It's the great Dante Read Through.
It's the great Dante Read Through, where we are reading through all of the comic strip, The Adventures of Nicolai Dante. Co-created by Robbie Morrison and Simon Fraser from the weekly science fiction anthology comic, 2000 AD.
I'm Simon Fraser.
And I'm Edie Nugent, freelance writer and Simon's wife. Join us as we swashbuckle our way through the Russian Empire of the future. Warning, there will be spoilers. We will be talking in depth about these comics, so if you haven't read them yet, listen at your own risk. To join our book club and read along with us, go to shop.2000ad.com to pick up the books in hard copy or digital.
Today we're reading One Last Night in the House of Sin and The Beguiling, found in Progs 2001 and 1234 to 1235.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, Edie.
Hello, irregulars, and welcome back to the Great Dante Read Through. So today we're reading The House of Sin, One Last Night in the House of Sin, and The Beguiling. So who wrote it? Who drew it? Who lettered it?
It was written by Robbie Morrison, of course. Who drew it? John Burns this time, in comedic form. And it was lettered, unusually, by Ellie DeVille, the much-missed Ellie DeVille, who's substituting for Annie Parkhouse.
All right. So, yeah, I just realized that, like, the title is One Last Night in the House of Sin, which is way more ominous
indeed
than this story is. But,
yeah.
We have a new year, the year of the Tsar 2670. It is Christmas Eve, and we have a Christmas special.
Yeah.
I am wary of a Dante Christmas special at this point in the story, it must be said. But the irregulars are gathered around a fire as snow falls, and Boris Grozny gripes that only officers of the rank above lieutenant are invited to join the Romanovs for a holiday feast. And only the leftovers are going to be distributed amongst the conscripted troops. And Dante reminds him he's part of a penal regiment, so it's not really supposed to be fun.
Indeed.
Which is fair. Just then, Elena shouts to arms as a giant, evil-looking train, at first, at least, bursts through the snow.
Yeah.
And it's, of course,
the Polar Express.
It's the sexy Snowpiercer, which is back.
Yeah.
And I just love John Burns having to put, like, his masterful painting to this crazy, like, sin train.
He did a great job making it ominous.
It does. It looks very menacing.
Having designed it not to look very ominous, it's suddenly like, whoa, intimidating.
Yeah.
Good. Lots of light. He's got lots of, like, point light sources, which is a good way of doing it.
Yeah. Obviously, we first memorably met this train in episode 10, The Movable Mask Feast.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we've seen it since then, but I actually looked through and I could not find it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, irregulars, can find it, if there is an instance of us seeing the sexy Snowpiercer sex train after the Movable Feast and between that and now, let me know. That's a no prize. So you can post on our Facebook community, which you should look up, The Great Dante Read Through, in the 2000 AD forum, or you can DM me on Twitter, at podtgdr. Madame DeGiorgi.
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 Mm-hmm.
DeGiorgi.
Indeed.
Is back. And thank goodness, because it's pretty bleak around here and it's supposed to be Christmas. I know you have said recently about that you have feelings about mixing fun with war, but like even World War One had a Christmas armistice. So I feel like this is okay.
The much overused Christmas football match.
Yes.
This is definitely a more exuberant tale and spectacularly drawn by John Byrne.
It looks so good.
It's so well done.
It's so great.
He's so good at this. His sexy ladies are just bursting out all over the place.
I find it incredible that this man is so good at doing like grisly battles and war, and then he can also do this.
Well, in fairness, he ribald did most cheesecake. Of his career was spent doing cheesecake. A lot of it. I mean, that was the nature of British newspaper comics. This kind of weird, weirdly chased cheesecake. Jane and he didn't do Modesty Blaze. He wasn't allowed to do that, but he's done a lot of kind of.
He wasn't
like
allowed to do that.
It's I think he applied to take over Modesty Blaze from Tony O'Donnell. And I don't think he got the job, which is bizarre.
That is bizarre.
He's so good at it. He's so good at it.
Fantastic.
There's a lot of, his career is checkered with cheesecake, and he's very, very, very good at it. I mean, this is incredible stuff.
It really is incredible. And according to an excerpt from The Love Train by Maria Beria, who's an author we've definitely heard from before.
She's prolific.
She is prolific. Georgi's train was one of the few enterprises that prospered during wartime. Indeed. And brought comfort and relief to both sides. And here's where I want to mention the Jacques Brel song, mm-hmm. Oui, Sauvant.
Yeah.
Or next, about mobile brothels in World War I, World War II, and the Indochine War. So yep. There were French versions of these. Mm-hmm. This is what this is evoking for me.
Right.
There are French versions of these, German military brothels, as well as, unfortunately, Japanese brothels in World War II.
Less pleasant.
Yes, and many of the women involved in these brothels were there against their will.
I'm fairly sure that mobile brothels were a lot less cheerful looking than this. It was a much more business-like affair and a great deal more tawdry.
With the consent of the people in them, but... Yeah,
this looks like a lot of fun.
But it's nice to see these happy sex workers.
This is, yes.
And Madame de Giorgi show up in this role that was, like, historically shady.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's progress.
Right.
We're in the future.
Yeah, I think...
So there's no reason we can't have happy sex workers in a mobile brothel. You don't need to enslave people.
Quite so.
Just pay them well, give them nice lingerie to wear, and we're off to the races.
Yeah. Well, quite so. And wash your clientele.
Yes. Well, this scene, we're about to get there. I love this part.
It has to be said that Madame Giorgi has been de-aged somewhat.
She has a bit.
Yeah, my version was in her 50s, and this one, she looks 30s, maybe early 40s.
Well, she does look very yummy in her striped corset, standing on the deck of the train. And
great
her,
outfits. Very,
her
very,
ladies of the evening are showing their wares alongside her. I think it's what's his name here? Is it the Coma something? The Coma, his name is.
No, Coma Grozny. Who
sums up the general reaction to this with fwarg? Just makes kind of a weird grunting noise. And Dante declares the troops should enjoy themselves. He's going to bill it to the Romanovs. He's going to bill. Their delights in the House of Sin.
Elena's not interested in this.
Elena is turning away disgusted, saying she'll keep watch while the men debase themselves. And I have to say at this point, I may have said this before, I get major queer vibes off Elena. Not necessarily as written.
No.
But her presence to me is, there's something very queer about her to me. And so I don't know that she'd actually turn away.
Gender.
Maybe it's wishful thinking on my part.
There's a bit of gender nonconformity.
There is. Yeah. And it's giving me feelings. Mm-hmm. It's giving me some feelings about Elena. Spatchcock gets in a nice and sleazy does it, which I like. Because it reminds me of Michael from The Good Place.
Okay.
It's like, keep it sleazy.
Yep.
We turn the page and we see general scenes of debauchery. I particularly enjoy Ursa hoisting a man over her shoulder.
Yeah.
Though I wish one of the other men wasn't running away from her. Right?
Yeah, maybe she likes that.
There's
maybe
another
she's
cheap.
Into that.
He looks, I don't know. Bit of a stretch. It seems like another cheap joke at her expense to me.
I'm sure it is.
You know, and a sex worker wouldn't behave that way. Like, sex workers are not there to have a good time. Like, they're there
it's
to.
Business.
It's business. It's work. Anyways, but Dante tells Madame Giorgi that he's not the Hellraiser he once was, just as she easily tempts him into the laps of three lovely young ladies.
Yeah.
So he can set a bad example for
his
troops.
Very little coercion required.
Right, yes. And
I
you know,
how we've suddenly gone, we've got floppy hair Dante back again.
Yes.
Basically.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even notice that.
So literally, it's like.
Where did his hair come from?
Well, I think. Yeah.
No, his hair just randomly came.
Because I think we've had quite a long gap here from.
From when he killed Constantine.
Constantine's funeral to now must be, I don't know, about 9 months. Because we got to Christmas suddenly.
Interesting.
Because he's wearing a coat at the funeral, which is obviously cold.
This is the battleship Potemkin.
Yeah.
2669. So, I mean...
It's about a year. A year's passed.
Imperial War. Yeah, we can't really tell what time of year it is. So let's just say he's let his hair grow.
The funeral is clearly
he was feeling empowered after the funeral and becoming a villain. And so he grew his hair
snowing,
out.
It's snowing in the funeral. And it's snowing now. So it's a year.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's say.
Let's say. But like, it's funny because how we left him in Potemkin was like him becoming this sort of like villain.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's like happy-go-lucky, grow my hair out, Dante.
One of our copyright radical tonal shifts.
Yeah. I wonder what happened there. That would be a fun, like if you were going to write in the margins.
Dante the Lost Year?
Yeah. I would love to see that. I mean, we were talking before about writing in the margins of how Dante got involved in the war
mm-hmm.
after him and Jenna had their breakup.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see like the lost time of that. And I would love to see the lost time of this, how he gets here.
Mm-hmm.
Cause he certainly does look like our old Dante. I can't believe I didn't even notice that. Wow. Flintlock is enjoying a caning.
Indeed.
That takes him back to his school days.
Didn't think that was going to be a card love. That was played.
And Spatchcock is getting a bath, which I totally enjoy and love.
She seems to be enjoying. He's definitely into it.
Yeah.
Weirdly, because he doesn't like having baths.
Well, listen, I guess all he needed was a really like hot lady to soap him up.
Girl.
And
yeah.
that's what he was missing.
Mm-hmm.
Just as everyone's enjoying some good, clean, dirty fun, who shows up to ruin the party but General Shitov?
That's his job.
Yes. He's going to commandeer the sexy train for the elite officers that are filing in behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And the irregulars all manage to stand up and salute. Though Shitov kicks poor dripping Spatchcock for his trouble.
Yeah, that seems unfortunate.
Yeah, they're in a brothel. That seems really...
Not only that, but it's neutral territory brothel. So it's like we assume there's a certain lack of hierarchy here.
Yeah.
One was, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like when you're at sea.
Yeah.
It's like international waters.
Mm-hmm.
The brothel.
Attention, rabble, officer in the house.
Yes. So Dante, of course, won't stand for this mm-hmm. and knees Shitov in the groin while lecturing him on not getting in the way of the soldiers who are actually fighting the war.
Indeed.
A brawl ensues, and of course, the irregulars have the upper hand.
Yep.
So Christmas Day, we cut to a day later, sees the irregulars brought in front of, is this Dimitri?
That's Dimitri.
He looks very different.
He's got a big coat on. It's a great coat.
It's the great coat, but...
It's great.
Super great, but... I don't know. He just looks different to me. But anyway, okay. So he's chastising them for being lewd and putting 17 officers and guards in the hospital. So those were their side. They were on the same side.
I think this makes them effective.
Yeah. No, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
As punishment, he says the irregulars will now lead the charge in every battle until the end of the war.
Okay.
So that fun shirt didn't last. But I'm questioning, like, this is a big war, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, how could they lead the charge in every battle? I feel like that's impossible.
Yeah.
Unless they have time travel.
It's a big war, but it's also very, very small because we only really deal with one small band of people.
It's like Portal. They set up, we're in the future, why not? They set up portals and they just keep sending the irregulars in as the front. Like once they make it through one charge, they
steadfastly refuse to die.
So we see a gag where Spatchcock and Flintlock are off at a house commandeered by the Romanov family for Christmas, and Spatchcock is taking a dump in the stew pot that the Romanovs are going to eat.
I think it's just Spatchcock there. That's Spatch. Same.
Oh, it's him twice?
Yeah, it's a problem when you overlap one character into the panel that he's also in. It makes it look like there's only one.
Especially because he looks so different with his pants down from the back.
A very, very rare storytelling faux pas from John Burns there.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, also, I mean, I could have just been reading too quickly, but in any event.
I made the same assumption to it.
Okay.
It's a little bit clunky.
Okay.
But anyway, otherwise, beautifully drawn.
Yeah. So that's it. Ba-dum-bum. Dump in the stew pot. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
And a big shot of an arse. And off we
go.
Okay.
So now we are moving on to the next book in the Hachette collection
that I'm reading, book
75.
Indeed.
And we are beginning The Beguiling.
And we get short hair again.
He cuts it off after the brothel.
Clearly,
he's like
something serious happened.
Yeah, something serious happened there.
I mean, I think this story basically happens out of strict continuity. It doesn't.
We talk about what he was involved in before he ends up here.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
I don't think right. so actually.
Right. Okay, so we're cutting out a lot here. There's big chunks of things missing.
Yes. So let's talk about The Beguiling.
Yep. Obviously,
who wrote it, who drew it, who lettered it?
Well, it's obviously written by Robbie. It's drawn by Steve Yole, who's on fine form, and Chris Blythe, also in great form today.
Doing the colors.
On the colors, and lettered by Annie Parkhouse.
We got Annie back.
The inimitable Annie Parkhouse.
Okay,
Great, great Steve Yole artwork on this. I was just looking at it earlier and just going, whoa, Steve was having a great time on this. It's really fun. Coloring is smashing. Chris Blythe, for my money, tends to oversaturate things a bit much, but his kind of crisp tonal stuff here is very good. It works really well with Steve Yole, and Steve is just really, just storytelling is fantastic, draftsmanship's fantastic, just great stuff.
Yeah. So Dante awakens in a comfortable bed, being tended to by three lovely young ladies.
Indeed.
One of whom takes a non-consensual peek at Dante's Johnson under the covers.
Okay.
Though, of course, we know Dante doesn't mind at all, right?
No.
One of the ladies informs Dante as he awakens that he staggered, wounded, and near death, clutching an imperial flag. Okay. So they believe he's on the side of the Tsar. So whenever that happened...
Was he using it to wipe his arse?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but he was out of it. And this is apparently good that he arrived this way, because apparently these sisters have been warned that Nicolai Dante is in the area, and they are prepared to kill him on sight.
Oh my goodness.
One of them says she will spear his testicles with her stilettos.
Yeah, so this is a take on a movie called The Beguiling, which is a very strange Don Siegel, Clint Eastwood movie from the 70s, I think. I forget the date exactly, but it's an odd little movie for the two of them, who were well known for doing relatively kind of macho, male-centric movies. This is a very female-centric movie where is it a Confederate or Yankee? I'm thinking maybe he's a Yankee soldier arrives in this plantation during the American Civil War. And,
Confederate plantation.
It's a Confederate plantation, so he must be a Yankee. And these young women tend to him. And it's a very strange movie, especially for the two of them in Eastwood and Siegel. But certainly worth a watch. And I remember discussing with Robbie before he did this, and he said he wanted to do it. And I was like, yes, that sounds like a fabulous idea. Because Dante obviously changes the dynamic considerably.
He does, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So one of them says that she would cut the weapons crest from his warm corpse. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting to note here that weapons crests were something that is now known to what we assume is nobility here. Because when we first were introduced to the weapons crest, they were like big hush-hush. And, and then we knew that the Tsar knew about them. But I didn't realize that had been passed on to like the noble
families. Well, we're now
families.
A year or two into the war. Yeah. So I think people are now fully aware of the extent of weaponry available.
Right. So this leads Dante to announce that he is Captain Quentin Durward of the 97th Imperial Riflemen.
That's his go-to secret identity.
Yes.
That's a reference to Walter Scott, obviously.
Oh, yes. I forgot that he had done this before. Yeah.
And he uses it again, too.
Yes. Okay.
And this is the first time we see the weapons crest disappearing.
Yes. I was just about to say, later alone in his room, a nude Dante is talking to the crest, and he learns that he was separated from the irregulars during some enemy shelling, and we learn that the crest can conceal itself, which is very cool. Mm-hmm. And I will say that the one bit of really confusing panel to me was this one, where I realized, reading on through the story, that it was a close-up panel of Dante's butt being grabbed by one of the sisters.
Mm-hmm.
I could not tell if that was a shoulder, or I did not know what was happening here.
Yeah.
This is the one who non-consensually, I can't tell who's who. They don't really ever
differentiate
between them.
But that's an Arbitov thing. We don't differentiate between Arbitov.
Oh my God, spoilers, Simon.
Sorry. Well,
Simon.
You read this.
My goodness. We were going to have the big reveal in as we read through it.
Mm-hmm.
You're the worst. It's very difficult to be in a marriage with someone who is so spoilerific as you.
Everybody who's listening to this has read this. Everybody.
I know, but it's a build-up. Anyway, the one who non-consensually peeped Dante's Peter appears suddenly behind Dante and grabs his behind, and he asks for some clothes, and she says, maybe someday, which I loved, actually, as her response.
Yeah, it's very domy.
She says she's more playful than her sisters and begins groping him non-consensually, but he gets into it pretty quickly.
Yep.
And of course, they collapse into bed in a tangle of limbs.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime later, Dante awakens to another of the sisters, And I'm like, do they have identifiable names? I think this one is Isabel, the next sister that comes in.
Don't know.
She comes into his room and she talks to Dante about how her family wants to marry her off to the foppish aristocrats. When she which she resents because she comes from a military family, and she proves this by cutting her clothes off and asking to fence Dante.
Okay. Subtle.
And I mean, he just woke up, you know. But they fight and oogle each other and flirt, and mm-hmm. Dante disarms who I think may be Isabel, and they collapse into bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get our payoff. Isabel tells Dante he's too good to be a rifleman and will ask her brothers to promote him to a more prestigious rank.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps he's heard of them, the Arbatovs.
Yeah.
So the Arbatov line is full of hot, fit, horny young women, is what we discover.
Yes, and sappy, gullible men.
Right. So is this like Darwinism? Like the Arbatov men that survive make good kids? Like they make hot ladies? But only good female kids. Dante and the Crest flee his bedchamber after Isabel leaves, realizing he's not going to go unrecognized for very long.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, did these sisters miss the giant naked billboard of Dante? Like, have they not recognized him? That billboard was everywhere.
Yeah, you would have to say that it's probably a good idea for him to run away.
Yeah, maybe it's the haircut. Maybe the hair, you know.
I don't know. It's as we were talking about earlier, it's like this society is on the one hand old style, very old, you know, kind of like based on 18th century ideas of warfare, where people could like control information, and also this on the other hand is supposed to be science fiction and modern, where everybody knows what's going on because you know you have international news sources, but nobody seems to know what Dante looks like.
No,
which is odd.
It's very bad media mm-hmm. distribution here. The third sister, as mm-hmm. Dante is fleeing,
mm-hmm.
encounters Dante and makes to seduce him as well, which she does
in the steam room
with a little light bondage.
Yeah,
and I have to say, mm-hmm. we get this like kind of lovely progression of like her wrist being tied up with the towel mm-hmm. as they sweat against like the planks in the mm-hmm. steam room, and they're making out, and it sort of melts into this vision of then the Arbatov brothers and their regiment mm-hmm. showing up to the mansion. I really missed these sex scenes. I'm really glad we're getting like a bunch of sex scenes.
Yeah.
I did not realize how much I missed it until we got to this point.
I'm a bit uncomfortable with the color hold across this splash page here, where there's obviously some kind of sexual activity going on wrapped up in steam, but the line work has been dropped out entirely, and basically the drawing's fallen apart.
Yeah, it's sort of this.
Give it some structure with the color, and it's not really happened here.
It kind of melts.
Yeah, it's not great. I don't love that. I mean, I think it's a nice page otherwise.
Mm.
I think I'd like to see the line work for that.
Yeah. Fair enough. Beneath this sort of melting forms, we see the Arbatovs come to the mansion estate, the Arbatov mansion estate.
Respect for doing a good big stairway.
Yes.
That's actually one of the harder things to do.
This is cutting to inside the
mansion, and there's a big grand stairway, and it's like staircase with all the. It's like that's.
You're getting ahead of me, darling.
Sorry, but that's the sort of thing that it makes my stomach drop.
Yeah.
Because it's like ugh, of all the fun things not to draw.
Yeah.
Stairways. Ugh.
But in any event, basically, you know, before we see one of the Arbatov brothers charging up the stairs, he warns his men not to look lasciviously at the sisters, which mm-hmm. is, of course, funny given what has been going on here.
Yep.
One of the sisters, who is apparently named Juliet, I can't really keep track when they keep changing clothes,
mm-hmm.
Stops the Arbatov officer who charges up the stairs, and we learn this is Grigori,
mm-hmm.
who apparently has taken over the defense of Vladigrad,
okay.
which is notable.
Mm-hmm.
She can't wait to introduce him to the hero Imperial riflemen that they've all taken turns rifling through. Get it?
Yeah.
Grigori enters Dante's room to say hello, but Dante gets the drop on him, of course, and I thought drowns him in a toilet.
That seems to be the case here.
But, well, I have a question about this later. So if that is drowning in a toilet, then that is the saddest Arbatov death that we've seen yet. That is the most ignoble.
But he doesn't seem to have killed him.
No, but that's what I'm seeing. So, as Dante attempts to flee, he's confronted by the sisters, three on the stairs, who have prepared a feast for him and for their brother. One of the sisters announces she's going to marry Quentin.
Mm-hmm. much to the shock of the other sisters.
Which sends the other two into quite a frenzy. Surely they will marry Quentin as they made love to him just recently.
Indeed, Isabel, Ophelia, and Juliet. Some Shakespearean stuff going on here.
And yes, we have three names. Not Portia. How to connect them, you I sure? don't know. So they begin catfighting. And just then an Arbatov brother. So you think this is Grigori, the one who just was put in the toilet?
He's got wet hair. Look, he's been drawn.
That's what I was
going
to say. Is that wet hair?
Yeah.
Okay. So he wasn't
so
killed
hard
in the toilet.
To tell them apart.
He was just knocked out somehow, temporarily waterboarded. Mm. So he enters the scene and shouts, "Damn you, Nikolai Dante," and Dante takes him out with a well-aimed silver plate to the head. We don't know if he's dead, but he certainly injures him, knocks him out. The sisters are understandably upset when they learn that they have bedded and are fighting over their sworn enemy, responsible for the deaths of at least three of their brothers and one castration, according to Dante.
It turns into a very aggressive foursome.
I feel like it's been more Arbatovs, but I guess not. Mm. They all attack Dante at once, and the fighting sisters and Dante crash through a window and land onto a convenient water feature.
As they do.
Dante flees.
This is something of a Robbie trope at this point.
Crash
People
through a window.
Crashing through windows
landing
and landing in
water
features.
I mean, that's just a trope straight up.
Sure.
Dante flees on a stolen chess horse as the remaining Arbatovs and their men pursue him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the end of that story. These were so quick.
How come? What?
We're done. That
yeah,
was
yeah, yeah. There's not a lot here. I mean, it's a funny romp, but
these
it's
two are both of these two together though.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very fast.
Steve's done these horses with these big butts.
Yes.
That's funny.
So what? Before I move on to something else, what do we think of these? How did you feel about these?
Good. I mean, good rompy Dante. I mean, it's like old school rompy Dante from before to remind people that yes, Dante can do that.
Right.
Strange inconsistencies with the hair, but that's, you know, it's not the artist's fault. They were just being told to do what they do. It was good fun.
Yeah.
I think Steve's very good at this kind of thing. Mm. He's not over... I think John Burns tends to kind of, like, change his style slightly for the comedic ones, and it becomes kind of, like, exuberant and kind of, like, bouncy and, like, we're having fun, kids! Whereas Steve can do action and fun at the same time, and it's more consistent. Which is more kind of how I do it. You know, Steve and I are more similar than that. You know, we're doing line work, we're doing colored line work, and it's the way we lay out pages is similar.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of it. It's more consistent with how I would do things. Not that I'm slagging off John, he's doing a fantastic job. It's just that when he's given a comedic story, he obviously changes tack substantially and it becomes this kind of bouncy, cheerful thing. Like, oh, that's not what he did like 4 pages ago.
Yeah. I think that's pretty cool, though, that he has that range is pretty amazing.
It's cool.
That's what we were talking about at the top of the
show.
It's
cool. It's just a different I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it's a different tack. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to see.
And, you know, I loved this gag of it being the Arbatov sisters. You know,
right.
I thought that was great.
Yep.
It was nice to sort of connect that back.
I mean, it's like the one gag story, yes.
Yes. Yes, and to think now that Dante could have possibly fathered some Arbatovs is also very funny.
Oh, joy. I mean,
maybe they have like space birth control or something, but since they
all
wanted to marry him, maybe not.
I think it's safe to say that we could do Nikolai Dante too, based on the children of Nikolai Dante. His illegitimate offspring are probably legion.
Oh my God, so many. So many.
Fascinating.
Because we've got some time here.
Yep.
I wanted to dip into some listener feedback.
Listener feedback?
Listener feedback.
Oh, my God.
This
is Colin again, isn't it?
No, actually.
No? Oh, okay. Sorry, Colin.
No, actually. Content Colin. This was our feedback on our last episode.
Which was?
The Battleship Potemkin.
Battleship Potemkin, yeah.
So
we're recording like
no,
3 weeks ahead.
No, I tell
right
a
now.
Lie.
Okay.
Because temporally I can't figure out where we are. Love and War. Feedback on Love and War.
Yeah,
thank you. We haven't gotten to Battleship Potemkin
yet. We're recording about 3 weeks
we
ahead.
We have gotten to Battleship Potemkin, but you have not, listeners. Yeah. So this is the Love and War
Look
feedback.
Look forward to that one.
Coming on the heels of the Rudenstein Irregulars.
Yeah.
So this is kind of controversial, right?
Indeed.
Our opinions on these...
Yes.
So,
well, not your opinions, my opinions.
Yes, your opinions.
Yeah.
You're being
very reasonable. I'm not.
I was. Well, you know, I mean, that's also. I wouldn't say that that's our. I don't want to go so far as to say that that's generally our positions. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
At least on this show.
So far, so good.
But in any event, people had feelings about it. You know, while I was initially apprehensive, and I know you were some as well, that, that people would maybe be turned off. We did have Jayware saying that the fact that we were nervous about this one acted as an enticement to him.
Good.
And he said it sounds perverse to say so, but it's fascinating to hear creators being critical of their own work, or in this case, work with which they're closely associated.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus Be Christ, another regular irregular.
It's Irish, by any chance?
said that, you know, your hostility towards the story made it more interesting to listen to.
Well, I'm glad.
So some people enjoyed it. But what I liked also that Jesus said was that he warmed to Dante during this war storyline. Mm-hmm. And we did get feedback like that from other people.
I completely
understand
that. That makes a lot of sense. Because up to this point, Dante was kind of a shit.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. He was a smug little smart aleck.
Yeah, and now he's having his teeth kicked in regularly, which is good. It's good for him. It's character building.
Yeah, it made him more human.
Yes, it does. Yes. It definitely does that. Yep.
Yes. And Font Solo, another regular irregular. Hello. We appreciate Font. You yep. so much, all of you.
Indeed.
He said that he hasn't read Dante in a long time, like 22 years ago, but... Mm-hmm. He thought it was like a little bit of sugar to help the medicine go down argument when we were talking about how you were having issues with mm-hmm. them being playful amidst the war. It was kind of like the sugar to help the medicine of the horrors of war.
I mean,
I think
one of the strengths that Dante has, and Dave Bishop said this in the interview we had with him, is that it can do a lot of different things. We can change quite quickly into different kind of things. Dante, like Dread, can be comedic or dramatic or somewhere in between all these things, and that's unusual for 2000 AD stories because they tend to be very much more narrowly focused tonally, and that's fine, and that's a strength of the story, and I'm happy about that. I don't know. As I said, and as I've said on the forums, I am emotionally invested in this, and I'm not quite decided on it, so I don't know.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting. I think it's. I feel that war stories should be. You have to pick a philosophical point of view on a war story, and I think you have to decide what you're going to say about war. And what we were saying earlier, a friend of mine actually wrote a piece about this in his blog, which was very interesting. David Cairns' blog, Shadowcast, which I recommend if you're interested in obscure film trivia. He was talking about the way that British media, particularly after the Second World War, had a very curious kind of neo-propagandist attitude towards it. Not like the First World War. The First World War, the stories and fiction coming out of it were quite negative and quite angry and quite sad. All Quiet on the Western Front, things like that.
Oof.
Which is very difficult. It's a very thing.
That book, I always tell you, I was assigned to read that book in like sixth grade.
Yeah.
That was on the summer reading list.
Right.
And all I remember about that book was that there was like half a chapter on a guy's infected wound
right.
in a trench. It really hit me. That stuck with me really hardcore.
That's what I think of
World War II.
Because I think the feeling of betrayal after World War I was substantial, and I think that the media reflected that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
They were less likely to make it a heroic war.
Why betrayal?
War. It was not the war people signed up for.
World War I?
World War I, yeah.
Why was it not the war they signed up for?
Because they were told it was going to be this glorious cavalry centric war.
Oh, and it was just like awful,
grinding
death.
Grinding, mechanistic
yeah.
horror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Was a modern war. Mm. And the stories that were told to get people onto the battlefield were based on 19th century warfare, which was a very different thing. Anyway, equally grisly, but less mechanized, less industrial.
Yeah.
So, then we have the World War II, which was very different, and the aftermath of World War II, and which basically I grew up with in the 70s, we're talking about, 25 years later, was war comics, action-adventure war movies, this stuff like, Tommy goes out there and kicks some Jerry ass, and, this kind of, it's very gung-ho, and it's very heroic, and until I'm trying to think of where there were a few anti-war movies of that period. What's that one? Richard Lester one with John Lennon's in. I forget what it's called, but there are a couple of more notable anti-war movies of the sort of 60s and 70s, but not very many. Most of them were very kind of heroic, you know, the...
Well, we had found this enemy that we could all hate together.
Yeah, which right? is weird.
This loathsome enemy that you were okay to want to kill. Which is, you could give in to your worst impulses as a person
as long as Nazis
are on the other end of it.
Which is weird because over in Germany, the Nazis were still in charge. I mean, all the people who were running Germany at the time were basically members of the Nazi Party during the war and basically came out after the war and took charge. And Germany was still that country. But we just kind of ignored it and had this kind of weird... fantasy version of World War II, which it took a long time.
We were importing like German, the best and the brightest of German, industry and bringing it to America to innovate. And I mean, these are Nazi war criminals.
Yeah. I mean, Werner von Braun and his company who created the NASA, basically, were
war
criminals.
So disturbing.
That whole period is profoundly morally compromised. Mm. And the media was not reflecting that at all. It was very uncritical. Unless you're thinking of things like maybe the Odessa file or something like that, where they're talking about how difficult it was to get war criminals prosecuted in Germany. That was popular media. But it really wasn't something that was talked about an awful lot. And, you know, there was people like the Simon Wiesenthal organization trying to find Martin Bormann and so forth. But there was really a very small number of these war criminals who were dealt with. Sorry, we're digressing substantially.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do we wrap this back to Dante?
But
you were talking about these influences of this media
childhood. Exactly. So
in the 70s.
Robbie and I were raised on these comics and these movies.
The propagandistic ones.
Yes. And Garth Ennis too, obviously. And, you know, we were raised in Commando comics and Warlord and, you know, battle action, these kind of things, which were very much heroic adventures in the war, with some notable exceptions, mostly written by Pat Mills, Charlie's War and so forth. So this is what this story is. I mean, Dante is basically a heroic World War II kind of narrative with the trappings of the Napoleonic era. But still, it's very much that kind of like heroic war story.
But we have this morally conflicted dude at the center.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's unusual, right?
Yes,
we see him doing bad and good.
Yeah, and he also is, you know, he's in a high position of privilege because he is a captain and he is, you know, the most heroic of all ranks. But also he's part of a noble family, so he's untouchable in lots of ways.
But
he has superpowers, so he's also unkillable. So it's very hard to really see the moral through line of this for me.
Well, here's what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. I think, and I'm going to get into another comment that's very detailed. Mm-hmm. There was a back and forth that you had on Facebook that was really, really good. With one of our listeners. So again, I encourage you folks, please interact with us on the 2080 forums or look us up on the Great Dante Read Through on Facebook, or you can tweet at us, whichever is your preferred medium. But we really, really do love to talk to you about this because this is a book club, right? We're reading this together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do you do in book clubs? You sit and you like discuss the books. So, so we really welcome your feedback and we will feature it in future episodes unless you tell us not to. You can absolutely chat with us and say, you know what, I don't want you to broadcast this, and we will not.
Yes.
That being said, I think that it's interesting, Dante, because though Dante, you were saying that last episode, that he has this huge advantage and he runs in and leads the irregulars, I think it was last episode, leads them into battle, and he's got this huge superpower advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that we have to remember about Dante is that that's very new to him. Mm. And most of his life, he was like living to die. Like he was living in the strafe of society that would die young, penniless, in filth. So he's still got that in him. And that's still the chip on his shoulder, even though he's got these huge advantages. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that that guides a lot of his thinking more than we realize. And
I think it's interesting because I think he is still opportunistic here.
Yes.
And he's still following power and money. And so, again, as much as he seems more clearly heroic in these stories, he is not really on the right side. There's no right side.
Yeah.
None of these people are good.
No.
And he isn't good either.
Well,
he's out there for his own look. He's taking advantage of situations to his own ends.
Yeah. And so Andy Cowburn wrote to us, and he did have a harder time with the episode because he basically feels different about the changes in Dante's character when war breaks out.
Mm-hmm.
He says he completely understands why he changes. So he says, you know, we're correct in that he undergoes a radical transformation, but he thinks that there are good, even though they seem irrational, reasons for this. And so he gets into sort of like what I was getting into with Jenna,
mm-hmm.
the other episode where I was talking about kind of how it built from her end, where she ends up and why she's so ruthless.
Yeah.
And he's basically following the through line for Dante, which is Jenna's rejection hits him hard because his childhood taught him that women are not to be trusted with your heart because ultimately they'll leave you, like his mother left
mm-hmm.
him. And in Jenna, he tries to open up to her and make a commitment, something that he didn't do with Ellie and that he regrets,
mm-hmm.
right? And after the loss of Jenna and Julia, he realizes that she's right. Jenna is right when she says you can't run away from who you are. And so in his mind, the Emperor and his father both bear responsibility for the terrible things that have happened, and now he wants them both to pay for this.
Mm-hmm.
But he thinks his strongest motivation comes from his responsibility to Rudenstein, and he knows that the war will come to his province whether he fights or not. But the last place that he is still loved will probably fare better if he leads them.
Mm-hmm.
So he has an outlet for all the rage that has been building behind the happy-go-lucky facade he's built since he was first abandoned by his mother.
Yeah,
and the war is giving him an opportunity to vent his anger and hatred.
And as I responded to Andy, is it?
Yes, you said there isn't...
Yeah, the Dante is an angry man. He's angry, frustrated, and I think that's something that we don't talk about, because we do talk about his happy-go-lucky nature, but I think a lot of the time he's masking quite a lot of rage, and I think that's something we could talk about.
Yeah, I mean, the sexual conquest is definitely a really, really good form of escapism, you
yep.
know? Like, what a great way. Drown yourself in
mm-hmm.
in sex is a great way to disassociate
mm-hmm.
and to not
yeah.
have to deal with things, right?
Yeah.
You're constantly jamming yourself full of sensory experiences and dopamine rushes.
I mean, he's an addict.
He's an addict, yeah, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
And that's fun, but that has a price, and there's a reason that people do that. And I think it is really interesting that we have this character who, as you were saying in one of your comments, holds up to such scrutiny, that this story
mm-hmm.
kind of holds up to us sort of all talking about it in this mm-hmm. way is really interesting and unusual.
I've just realized that the chess horses here have got the wrong logo on them, got the wrong symbol.
Oh, the chess horses at the end of the Guiling?
They've got this weird, they've got the double-headed eagle, which is a Romanov
crest. Yeah, that's
a
Romanov crest.
Yeah, and they're supposed to be arbiters.
Yeah, their tails are also flailing, and their tails don't flail.
Hmm.
Like, they're,
yeah.
you know, they're metal, set metal fixed things, but it's okay. It's okay, Steve Yule.
It's not your fault.
There's no worries.
There's editors for that, apparently.
Wait, editors exist?
Yeah.
So, you know, Andy also started comparing Dante to Russian literature, which I thought was super interesting. Something that he studied. And so he has a greater understanding of...
As I said to him, I think it would be very interesting to ask Robbie how much Russian
literature
he has
read. Yeah, and what he's read.
It's an interesting point.
If you look at this as a Russian epic, right? Which, you know, they are interesting. Russian storytelling is very interesting. And
yes.
it is definitely full of twists and turns and sort of elongated...
Yes.
Stories. I would compare it to the sort of Jacobean theater
mm-hmm.
back, you know, there was like, you know, Shakespeare and then the Jacobeans
mm-hmm.
who were like, you know, doing, they were sort of like the blockbuster films of their day. There was
mm-hmm.
a lot of blood, a lot of death, a lot of weird gender bendy
mm-hmm.
characters, you know,
mm-hmm.
long histories, bloodiness.
Yeah.
And I think that what little I've seen of Russian literature and Russian theater evokes that same sort of thing. So we're definitely getting there with Dante, where there's kind of incestuous things going on. There's weirdness. There's long lineages. Yeah.
Yeah.
So viewing it from that standpoint,
mm-hmm.
the character shift maybe is
mm-hmm.
could be considered an homage, and we won't know unless we ask Robbie.
Indeed.
And hopefully we can rope him in and ask him.
Probably are missing to a certain extent, and maybe we could follow up some other night time. Not right now. I think maybe there's a longer discussion for later. Is that as much as this is a Russian epic, it's actually created by two Scottish people and written by a Scotsman. And it probably has more to say about Scottish
yep.
literature than maybe
this is what
Russian.
I was saying. Like, what about this story? You know, you were talking about Russian epics, right? Yeah. And obviously, regardless of what Robbie has or hasn't read, he was clearly inspired by Russian history and Russian storytelling. So what about this sort of backdrop appeals to a Scottish writer, right? Scotland definitely has its own history of fighting tyranny, being struck between two terrible options, ruler-wise. Mm-hmm. So I think that's super fascinating to look at it from
that point of view. The original concept for the story, which was substantially changed over the years, was two Scottish mercenaries during fighting for Peter the Great. That was originally Robbie's pitch.
Who were the two Scott mercenaries? We have Dante and who?
No, they weren't. They were not even Dante back then.
Oh,
They were called Keg and Breck.
This is new. I've never heard this before.
No? Well, there's artwork somewhere for that. Anyway, that was kind
you
of...
You drew them? Half,
I did, like, two character sketches, wow, that's okay. All. But that was the original kind of concept, and then it was much changed and became a Nicolai Dante, and then became a science fiction epic. Or Robbie could tell me more details about that. It's a long time ago, and I'm remembering. Originally it was more Scottish, overtly Scottish. How Scottish it is now, I don't know. But clearly, the romance, I think the romance of Imperial Russian history is great, and it's a bit more doom laden than Napoleonic history, perhaps, and French history is. I think maybe it's easier to relate to Russian history for a Scotsman is to relate to French history.
Yeah.
It's bigger as well.
Scrappier,
much, much larger.
And kind of at a terrible disadvantage, right? The French are often very, very rulery and triumphant.
Well, I mean, Napoleon. Napoleon is the standout figure of that period. One of the greatest standout figures
in
history.
Scotland never got there, unfortunately.
No, we didn't have a Napoleon. We had a
brief moments.
If you look at Scottish history, it tends to be rather kind of small scale by comparison. Mm-hmm. Scrappy, guerrilla fighting, very few standout battles. The numbers are not there. Mm. Whereas Napoleonic epics and Russian literature is full of these gigantic cataclysmic battles, which is obviously the attraction of this.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
Mainland Europe was just a bloodbath.
So thank you to all of our listeners for writing us and for thinking so deeply about this and reading along with us. Yes. It really makes this fun for us, and we hope fun for you. Mm-hmm. So we are closing the book on Dante for today, but we will be back next week with Fiends.
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 I feel like I can't pronounce Fiends. That, articulate that. Fiends. Mm. We hope you enjoyed our podcast, and if so, please subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave ratings or reviews wherever you can, and please tell your friends. Word of mouth is great. Tell them to join the read-through. Follow us on Twitter. Mm-hmm. At PodTGDR. Let us know what you think of the podcast, of Dante Comics, whatever is on your mind. I'm Edie.
I'm Simon.
And we will catch you next time.
Bye.